And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome H. Ripley Rawlings IV back to the program today. Rip is a retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel. His first book was the New York Times bestseller, co-authored with Mark Graney, Red Metal. Last year was his solo debut, the first in the Tice Asher series, Assault by Fire. Today we'll have the first of a two-part interview about his latest in the series, The Kill Box, which is published by Pinnacle Fiction. Well, Rip, thanks for coming back on Book Talk this year.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is the second book in the Tice Asher series, and it's called The Kill Box. In the last one, Assault by Fire, Russia invaded the United States and was remarkably successful. So where do things start as The Kill Box starts off?
Well, so this one starts a couple months after the initial invasion. The Russians, as you just mentioned, have been very successful in their initial gains. They've made it into off the coasts and are starting to spread inland a little bit. They've taken the major cities. You know, I've very purposefully written it so that you don't know, I don't know, what's happening in Philadelphia or New York, because we are focused on one United States Marine officer and his cadre of kind of men and women mountain fighters. So it is intended to be this, you know, second view of what things look like from a very, I don't want to say myopic, because he does know what's happening a little bit outside that area, but from a very kind of mountain-centric, up in them their hills type perspective. So this case, you've got Tice Asher and his gang. They've won some and they've lost some. And their perspective is their homeland has been attacked and they want to continue to try to, you know, defeat the Russian forces. But the Russians have made some great gains, as you said. And so the Russians now are trying to consolidate those gains. And so that's where we find ourselves at the beginning of the second book.
And the fog of war does have them socked in.
They are. Yeah. And of course, that's a great term. The fog of war, it's interesting because I think even with today's technology, people have this very odd perspective that we're omniscient on the battlefield, and we're not at all. The battles that we fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, North Africa, all over the place in recent history are very much proof of the fact that even with the most advanced modern technology working, it doesn't give you a clear picture. In fact, you're lucky to know 25% on any given day of what's actually happening. So Tice has much less than that. Tice is fighting a little battle in West Virginia, but he's obviously connected to larger things. So he, in the first book, he was given kind of forcibly the vice president of the United States and, you know, the surviving cabinet, or at least those that they were able to escape up into the mountains. And he is given the task of trying to get them out of the country so that they can continue to at least provide guidance in absentia from up in Canada. You know, that's the first book in a nutshell, is that Tice is given this very big mission and it surprises him. He's not expecting to be thrust onto any kind of world stage, but sure enough, he has a very major role to play. So the fog of war over and over again for Tice, because his forces just have no idea what's happening outside of their own small mountain ranges up in the Alleghenies.
And it seems West Virginia is well situated for this type of thing, being mountainous terrain, but also not having many major cities. So any conveyance of materiel and troops between the north and the south and coming from out west back to up east seems like West Virginia might be a good point to transfer things through.
Yeah, I think it's a great position. It, you know, a lot of this came from the fact that when I was in the Pentagon, we practice what's called COOP or DCP. And this is where you have to reconstitute the military functions broadly in another location. So we would practice what happens if we're nuked on the one hand. You know, the Pentagon takes one through the running lights, a nuclear bomb. We still obviously have to continue to fight on behalf of the American people. It's unclassified now, but Site R is one of the most famous locations for people to go reconstitute. I think people also know the Greenbrier is where, you know, the civil aspects of our government were supposed to reconstitute back in the day. You know, because of the undulating mountains, the Alleghenies provides a tremendous, I would say, shield against anything radiological, but also causes, you know, as it has in the past thousands of years of warfare, mountains are a barrier that are difficult to pass. Aircraft make things a little easier, but for the most part, moving troops and moving materiel becomes very hard when you throw mountains in. So a lot of this, at least the general thought, came from what did we do to reconstitute ourselves in the event of a real war? And a lot of it happens in them, their hills. And so West Virginia is a great place. And if guys and gals, inevitably, as they would do if someone invaded, move up into the mountains to continue to fight, this is kind of what I believe it would look like, at least.
So how much of those official reconstitution plans have you repurposed for the Asher series?
Well, I'll say the ghost of them are all in there and kind of leave it at that, because obviously those are heavily classified. So I would say, you know, my knowledge of how to do Coupe and DCP definitely comes into play. Nothing classified, obviously, in the book, because I can't do that. But I, you know, it's funny that you asked that, Stephen, because my position, although I had to research all of our Coupe and DCP locations, my location, because I was the nuclear officer and the strategic Pacific plans officer for the Marine Corps, was in an aircraft. And so my job was to try to get across the Potomac with the commandant of the Marine Corps and then board an aircraft with him. And it's about as much as I can say. But for me, it was a frightening thing because I had to abandon everything else. So family and everybody else, you know, they're the guys that were going to Site R, because that's now unclassified. The guys that were in my office that were going to Site R could tell their families and warn them and say, hey, you know, something's coming and we have to get out of Dodge, you know, grab the kids from school, pack a bag, you know, get out of the city as quickly as you can. I couldn't do that. My job was so classified that immediately had to find the commandant and then go with him any best speeds and via any available means. There was usually a helicopter or something that would have been waiting for us, and get across the river to the Air Force bases and depart from there. So my position would have been a little bit, I think, a little more riskier than Tice's. Tice gets to run up into the mountains. And, you know, once you get behind some trees and once you're a little away from the city, you've got some protection. Not quite the same when you're in an airplane.
So fortunately, you never had to bug out because of a nuclear attack. But in your mind, thinking about it, you know, how do you deal with that stress of not being able to warn your family? How did you come to peace that with that was something you would have to do?
I'm not sure I ever did, Stephen. I still think about it to this day. And there were definitely times when we would do drills. You know, the greatest thing about doing military drills is it fills in the blanks. You have an idea, a concept of what you're supposed to do. So conceptually, you're clear on what the actual orders entail. So the orders are very specific, do A, B, and C, and then you fill in the blanks as a military officer should. But then when you do a drill, it kind of fills in all the extra stuff and you have an opportunity to look at it and say, well, what would I do? And doing drills with the commandant as we practiced nuclear stuff and doing drills with the commandant as we practiced escaping the Pentagon, it definitely filled in the blanks for me. And there's no way to really reconcile it. It's you're abandoning everything that you know, and you're doing your duty. So I don't know. I knew I would do it. I mean, I thought about it in my mind and thought, well, this will be hard, but I know my wife, she's made of solid stuff. She'll take the kids and they'll make sure that they get out of danger.
And so working in this nuclear paradigm, how upset did you get when you would hear people say nuclear?
All the time. I know when I was a kid, my sister corrected me when I was 8, 9, 10, 12. You remember those days when, you know, Red Dawn, the movie was out, and we remember the old TV miniseries The Day After. Mm-hmm. That scared the bejesus out of all of us when we were younger. And we practiced going up in them their hills. The hills for us back then, my family's mainly from Virginia, but we grew up in Colorado. So we grew up in mountains and we would practice, you know, kind of Red Dawn stuff when I was a kid. And we, of course, that was the days of duck and cover. So in school, there were radiological symbols this way to fallout shelter. It didn't help that we were right near Rocky Flats where they built the nuclear bombs. And of course, you also had what's it called Cheyenne Mountain, which was the headquarters for NORAD in Colorado. So as kids, you know, we thought about this kind of stuff all the time. So I think, you know, some of that practice came from growing up in a nuclear era. Nowadays, if you ask young men and women in the service, I don't think they have any fear of nukes. To them, it just doesn't exist. They know it's there. When I was the warfighting department head, my last job was, you know, once you're finished with kind of your battalion command, if you're lucky, they kind of select you to be that wise old goat down at the Marine Corps War College. And my job down there was to be the warfighting department head. So I was in charge of all of the warfighting curriculum. And I injected a nuclear section into it. I said, we need to spend at least 2 days talking about nuclear deterrent, because the majority of the millennial military officers really don't even know about the triad. They have no idea what it is. And they at least need to know, what is this technological, what are these technological pieces? How do they fit into the larger puzzle? Because if we do go into another war with, you know, in this case, maybe North Korea, or hopefully not China or Russia, but maybe Iran, if we fight a nuclear opponent, what would happen? Our planners, our officers need to know. And so we injected about a 2-day piece of curriculum. I was glad to hear from kind of my replacement's replacement that they still have it in there. So at least that's one little indelible item I put on there, is at least to strike the fear of nukes into, you know, many generations of officer. They're probably cursing that, but, you know, I'm glad that they're learning it.
We had another guest who grew up near Rocky Flats, Kristen Iverson, and wrote a book called Full Body Burden about the ecological and medical ramifications of the plutonium they were using there building the weapons. And I think the factory was disguised as like a Glad plastic bag factory or something. Mm-hmm, that's what people were told that was there instead of very dangerous nuclear materials.
When I was a kid, we had, it was back in the, you know, 70s, there were protests. There were, I'll never forget that someone laid across the railroad tracks where they were attempting to move.
I think Daniel Ellsberg was one of them.
Yeah, that's right. And they were trying to move nuclear material. It's weird that years later, I was with a Marine unit. The Marine Corps didn't have special forces for many years, but it's a unit that would be considered special forces called FAST, Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Team. And so our duties were dealing with nuclear weapons and that kind of thing. And so we guard the Navy's nukes, if you didn't know that. That includes nuclear fuel as much as it does nuclear weapons. But, you know, all of a sudden I'm guarding nuclear trains. It's weird because I remember reading as a kid about guys laying across the tracks to try to prevent these nuclear weapons from leaving Rocky Flats. But no, there were a lot of ecological disasters that occurred. They had thousands of pounds of nuclear material that went missing. A lot of it's believed to have kind of gone up into the rafters because they had these exhaust fans that I think were, you know, blowing out material or trying to blow out excess material as they put components together. But there were people who sat in offices in Rocky Flats that ended up getting irradiated. And they did irradiate quite a bit of the area. I think they're still finding areas. I think we believed naively in the 60s and 70s that these companies would do the right thing when it came to putting this stuff together. But in some cases, they were burying, you know, plutonium or at least detritus, you know, radioactive gear and equipment on parts of their facility. And years later, you know, a Geiger counter shows us that they've got stuff that's been left. So it's a shame to see. I can see both sides of that. I hope we never, ever use those weapons there. Anybody who's ever worked in that realm and really, truly understands what we still have left and what the Russians still have left understands that these are the worst things that we could ever have. I don't know. As always been said, warriors are the ones that are least interested in going to war.
Back in the kill box, General Custis, who we met in the first one, he's a retired general, and he saw the effects of a tactical nuke, and it affected his health greatly.
Correct. He's the wise Yoda. He's the Patton Yoda all mixed into one. And, you know, in some ways, when you remove Google and you remove the internet from a military unit, you know, having a guy like General Custis is fantastic because he's kind of a living Google. He's the guy who knows battles from all of ancient history and can inform our wonderful warriors on things that they might consider as they're planning their next move. But yeah, he did stare into the blast of a nuclear weapon that occurred. And in the first book, it will come up again, but the nuclear weapons were limited in use and they went directly for those, the Russians used them directly on locations that they knew had our most dangerous weapons in the United States. And so they hit and struck armories, they hit aviation facilities, they hit anything that they knew the larger left behind, remain behind military forces could use against them. And so they did it. It's very, very precision. Most people don't know this, but as we reduce strategic nuclear stockpile, the Russians do so in kind. So but from the START treaties, the SALT treaties, we've always been very good at calibrating how many should we reduce. I'm very proud to say every, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, we do reduce. We're not really increasing our nuclear arms stockpile. In my mind, we should continue to reduce them until we have just the bare minimum that we need in order to make sure that, you know, we can respond if somebody else wants to try to annihilate us. I've come to grips with that item as well, by the way. But in this case, and still to this day, what most people don't understand is the Russians have never really reduced their tactical nuclear weapons. They have a stockpile. We don't really have one anymore. It depends on kind of how you define what's a tactical nuclear weapon. But in a lot of cases, we had artillery pieces. We even had this nuclear bazooka back in the day that would fire, you know, a small nuclear weapon on the battlefield. So the Russians still have it. In book one, they disguise them in cargo ships, and they use what's called the Scarab II, which is a intermediate range missile. It doesn't go ballistic. It can if you want it to, but it can stay below the radar. So it can look like a very fast moving aircraft, or you can even have it, you know, fly below that level. And they fire at very precise targets across the United States. And unfortunately, you know, General Lawton Custis is a retired one-star general. He's got a lot of experiences, but he looks directly into the blast and it blinds him. In some ways, that's what leads him to Tices. He's looking to help. His family is wiped out by the blast, and so he has nowhere to go, but he has a tremendous amount of knowledge. So he's a great addition, and Tice and the band of Merry Mountain warriors welcome him immediately.
Now, the relationship between Asher and General Custis is an interesting one, and I like how the general, instead of just giving Tice answers, he asks him questions that makes Tice think about it, so that in a way he's preparing Asher in a way of thinking instead of just giving him easy answers.
No, you're exactly right. I think the best mentors I ever had did that to me, and that's where that came from. I had some very good generals, General Rocca, General Nicholson. I've had some general officers that I work for who are extremely wise men. I mean, you know, you see generals get relieved in the news a lot, and you see them with egg on their face for doing something, you know, that's not that great. But if you know anything about the military, I know you do, Stephen, but if you know anything about the military, you know that to make it to one star, you have to be a very, very good, thoughtful, in-depth person. You have to be four-dimensional. So Custis in the book is that guy. He made it to one star because of who he was. He was a smart guy. And so he trains Tice in the same vein, which is, I don't think Tice knows this. Tice thinks he just knows all the answers, but he doesn't. What he does know is he knows a lot of history. And so he tends to query Tice to kind of goad Tice into thinking about the answers. So that's what was done to me, is I had general officers who took the time to really learn things and not just give me answers. And I think that's a very kind of father-son relationship. So, you know, I worked for General David Petraeus in country in Afghanistan, and I worked for a lot of other general officers, Army and Marine Corps. I've worked for not as many admirals, but the best of the best of those gentlemen and ladies were the ones that took the time to make me think about a problem and not just give me answers. So that's the relationship I set up for Tice and General Custis.
So at this point, at the beginning of the book, how many fighters are in the 150th at this point, and what's their tactical capability?
Well, I leave that a little bit vague. So you have a group of units that have been hodgepodge together. In book one, they were all together for an exercise called Ridge Runner, where they basically just took some Marine reservists, some Army National Guard, some Army reservists, and sent them together up in the mountains and said, okay, you know, we need to do an interoperability exercise. All of you units are supposed to be able to fight together if the balloon goes up, which obviously it does. And so, you know, you get the impression that they don't really believe that that could ever happen. But, you know, their hodgepodge-ness comes together very nicely once the Russians actually attack. So the exact reason that they're training in this exercise, those are the reasons that they come together and actually fight against the Russians. You have less than 1,000 men. Their capabilities are one special forces company, an Army Special Forces company, which really takes it through the running lights in the kill box. So they take a tremendous amount of casualties. You have a Marine 4th Light Armored Reconnaissance Company. So it's one company from 4th LAR. So that amounts to about 16 total LAVs. And they have a major, in this case, Major Tite, well, Lieutenant Colonel now in this book, but he starts out as major in the first book, running his unit. You have the 150th West Virginia National Guard, which is a cavalry regiment on paper. If you went down to visit them, you know, at any given time, they're actually about a company worth of men. And they are the ones who bring the leadership because it's, you know, their state. So they decide to, you know, make them, the rubric is they'll push all the other forces underneath them. And so you have this guy, Colonel David Nepo in book one, who's not really that great at tactics. You get the impression he's more about himself, but he will show up again, by the way. But he is the guy who is running the whole show. And then a medical unit shows up from DC. And these are all real units. So I used actual units that are in the United States that are there in time of war and ready to do their duty and that do exercises, interoperability. I mean, all of this is based on, you know, reality. And those units come together. Colonel Nepo goes MIA. So no one knows where he is exactly. So you have the next in the chain of command, the guy who was filling in the role as the executive officer, major, and then Lieutenant Colonel Tice Asher, who has to take over the show. He's not sure he's the right guy for the job because it's a hodgepodge of units, but he's thrust into it and has to kind of figure it out.
people in the real world units that you're using in the book, do you know any of them that have read the books and what their feelings are and how you represent it?
I ran into a guy from the 150th Cavalry who was thrilled. I mean, it was kind of really neat. But he was a guy who actually was doing some taxidermy for me. I hunt regularly. And I got a bear last year and several deer. And he was doing some taxidermy for me. And so I gave him the book when he started to do the taxidermy. He had never heard of me before that. I wish he had, but he hadn't. And then when I came to pick it up about 6 months later, he had read the book. And he was just thrilled. And he's now become a, you know, number one fan. And he's, you know, thrilled for the personal acquaintance as much as I am to have another guy in the 150th that I know. He's a neat guy. He's a cavalryman. He's an enlisted man. And I won't mention his name just to kind of protect the innocent, but he's never said that I've got anything wrong in the book, but he's said that if I need any help, let him know. So hopefully that means I'm doing well enough that he doesn't feel the need to correct, you know, anything that I'm getting wrong with the National Guard. I was, as you know, active duty Marine. So you have to be very on guard, pun intended, that you don't mess up other services because they have their own particular forms and functions as we do in the Marine Corps. And if you use an ism that's out of character for them, they'll be the first ones to call you on it.
Off the main track here, are y'all having a problem in West Virginia with chronic wasting disease with the deer population?
Yes, CWD is very bad. It's mainly up in the north right now, but CWD, it's even entered into Virginia. And as we mentioned, kind of as you and I were warming up, we split our time between Virginia and West Virginia. Yes, it's not good. I don't know that everybody really gets this, but hunting serves a very important function for animal control. I think there's a lot of people that would just, maybe they believe that, you know, letting deer kind of do their thing is a good thing. The problem is many, many years ago, well before, you know, even our nation was a full nation, we started hunting all the predators in the area. And so the red wolf that used to live and roam up through West Virginia is gone. There's really not any red wolves anymore. In fact, the wolf population on the eastern United States, I'm not sure that any really exist. Someone else might be able to tell me exactly how many, but they're in zoos. But they used to control the deer population. Now the deer population has absolutely exploded. And without any natural predator besides humans, if you don't let people hunt, then diseases like CWD or chronic wasting take over the herds. Deer ticks, that's something simple also. That affects humans. The deer tick population has exploded along with the deer population. And you can go back to the Middle Ages to see what happens when you let vermin bring in other bugs. But it's terrible. You know, people are getting Lyme disease at a rate we've never seen before up in the mountains. We've had ticks on our dogs up there in West Virginia in the mountains that at least our neighbors that have lived there for 20, 30 years said they'd never had ticks, never had mosquitoes. All of a sudden with the warming, global warming, and also with the deer population exploding like it is, they're getting ticks on everything. Everybody's getting ticks up there, and quite a few people are suffering from Lyme disease. I don't want to go too deep into hunting, but yeah, we've got a lot of that stuff happening. Chronic wasting is terrible.
And you mentioned climate change. In a military context, what challenges does global climate change present to the American military?
Well, we confronted it directly. When I was in the Pentagon in 2011, that was a major item. I did a war game with the CIA. We can't get into any of that, but suffice to say that, you know, everybody around the table acknowledges that it causes major issues. I mean, you know, it's funny because Canada was at the table at some of these and they kind of, I would say smugly, you know, I love our Canadian neighbors, but they very smugly were like, well, we'll sell you guys water when you guys turn into a desert. It's like, gosh, you guys are already on, you know, stage, whatever that is. You know, it affects how we use fuel, how much the military tries to do sustainable energies. I think your average citizen doesn't know, but we spend a huge amount of money on fuel. And so having even our bases just use more solar and use more wind cuts back tremendously on any petrochemicals that we're using to try to fuel everything from generators to who knows what.
How are the civilians of West Virginia faring during this Russian occupation?
Well, we get to see that in the opening of the book. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, because it's mainly civilians that read my book. I want to make sure that they, and you know, I have a lot of civilian characters. You know, the military guys, the ones kind of trying to run the show, but, you know, I'm sure we'll get into it, but Mayor Holly is an example of a civilian that maybe actually is running the show. So we tend to think that the military will, you know, enact martial law and kind of do their thing. But in this case, the Russians are in control of the major population centers on most of the East Coast. You get the impression that there are some cities that maybe just don't know what's going on. But the Russians control the internet, they control the radio, they control every means of communication. So, you know, what are the civilians dealing with? Well, they've come out of a winter. The Russians very astutely attacked kind of at the end of the winter. So they deal with winters all the time. They've dealt with warfare in winter from, you know, Nazi Germany all the way back to Napoleon. So they know how to fight during winter. So they were quick to fight at the end of the winter so that we would be kind of back on our heels when it comes to fighting in the cold. It's not that big an effect for them because they have a fully winterized military. But that means that they're directly into their occupation in the spring. So the civilians are dealing with the same thing, which is they've come out of winter. They were generally prepared for winters, as we all are, you know, in January, February of the year. But now they have to rely on the Russians to provide them basic services. But then the Russians get to continue to fight insurgents in the spring. And you get the impression that the computer that the Russians are using, they have a very advanced computer called the Spets-4, which I won't do justice to the actual Russian name, but it's a special invasion calculating machine. And the intent of this machine is that it calculates variables. And it's the one that basically gave them the impetus to attack at the end of winter, because that's when American forces are vulnerable to the cold. But the citizens are dealing with it as best they can. And you see a group of farmers in the beginning of the book that they've got full stocks, but they don't really know what's happening. And they see a lot of people coming through their valley. Some are citizens that are just fleeing the population centers and need some food, or in some cases, maybe steal food from them. In some cases, they see military units. And what's shocking to them is not necessarily the Russians that they see flying overhead or driving through the town, because none of them really seem to stop in their little tiny town that's shown in the book. But it's the U.S. units that are fleeing the Russians that are most shocking to them, because they realize the U.S. units are in terrible shape. They are in tatters, you know, physically and mentally. And they realize, well, holy cow, you know, this war is right here. And our military is getting beaten very badly. So the citizens are trying to get by. I think the way I put it in the book is they're doing the same thing that they did since, you know, the food rationings of World War II and the battles that sending young sons and daughters to Korea and Vietnam, which is they're growing their crops, guarding their farms, and locking and loading their rifles.
So how does Tice keep from violating the Third Amendment to the Constitution?
Well, I think it's hard. He has that discussion with General Custis at the end of the book. But in the middle of the book, he does talk to Mayor Holly. And, you know, he wants to do everything he can to fight the Russians. But at the same time, he's kind of got his hand tied behind his back. He doesn't really know where he's going to get his supply. He's not getting any orders from up on high. So he's not quite sure what his disposition towards the citizenry should be. He's just a little bit concerned about making sure that he doesn't step on any toes. But meanwhile, as I think any Marine would be, he's focused on the enemy. So he has to ask a lot of questions. And in a lot of cases, he has to ask the elected representatives, hey, what do you want me to do? What am I supposed to do? Now, he is in touch with the vice president. So, you know, it wouldn't be a very exciting book if he wasn't in touch with any kind of national level leaders. So I picked, obviously, characters that are, in this case, have a more of a strategic impact than they really understand themselves. But he has to ask questions. He has to understand, you know, what do you need me to do? But in this case, the vice president kind of gives him an assignment.
H. Ripley Rawlings IV is the author of The Kill Box, which is the second installment in the Tice Asher series, which is published by Pinnacle Fiction. Join us next time for the second in this special two-part interview. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced by Stephen Usry and is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. Any retransmission or reproduction without the express written consent of FM 89.3 WIPL of the Memphis Public Library and Information Center, a department of the City of Memphis, is strictly prohibited.